And good evening. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio. It's good to be back for another week, and we are very privileged this evening to have with us Kathy Wilkerson, who is the author of Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman. And for people who were born in the past 30 years, we might need an explanation of what a weatherman is. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The book is marketed. The cover presents it as a story of the weatherman and the weather underground, and an incident with bombs exploding in your stepfather's house in 1970. But the bulk of the book, it happens in the 60s, leading up to that period. Could you give us maybe a brief summary for those who haven't read the book, because I have so many questions I want to get to, but briefly, what was Students for a Democratic Society, and what was your life like in the 1960s?
Well, you're completely right about the bulk of the book is actually about the 50s and 60s.
I stand corrected, the 50s and 60s.
But the incident in March of 1970 frames the story, and the story really is based on how did I get to this place in 1970 where I was in a house where a bomb accidentally went off and people were killed. And so it starts back at the beginning of the story, and I was in SDS all through the 60s, and I started when SDS was active as supporters in the civil rights movement and in community organizing, both black and white communities. And then SDS was trying to grapple with the question of inequality and with the dream of furthering participatory democracy. And we very much saw ourselves as part of a tradition of people that went all the way back to the founding fathers and before, of people that struggled to make democracy a reality, because as the founding fathers envisaged it, it was a very kind of elite democracy. So the union movement included many people, the civil rights, abolitionist movement and the people who fought in the Civil War expanded the electorate to some extent, and the suffragette movement expanded the electorate yet again. And so the civil rights movement was kind of the last great wave to expand the electorate, although we will be defending that clearly in the next election and for quite a while to come. So SDS really took on a number of issues and ended up at the end of the 60s really focusing on the war in Vietnam and the question of how do you bring peace to the world.
And reading through as someone who has been a peace activist in Washington, D.C. during a more recent war, the ongoing occupation of Iraq, is very, very interesting to read your experiences in that same city 30 years ago, and the conflicts between the different groups, the different agendas, black rights, women's rights, those who want to be more aggressive, those who want to be more passive, the different personalities, and it's quite educational for someone trying to accomplish some of the same ends now. What did you learn that you would most want to pass on to people trying to be activists for peace and justice, and in particular to end a foreign war at this point in time?
Well, you framed it exactly how I was thinking of it in the book, which is bringing change is a really complicated process, and it's not just a great romantic surge. But it's very complicated and complex and rich. And so I felt like that rich, complicated part of the story of the 60s had not adequately been told. And it really is, as you described it, people having a vision, a common vision for greater participatory democracy and for peace and cooperation in the world, but coming from very, very different experiences and with different emphases. And so in the 60s, we really, we learned how to, the civil rights movement embraced everyone with a single agenda, but as the 60s went on, the movement got much more diverse and rich. And while civil rights framed it, framed everything in the 60s, and the experience and the successes of the civil rights movement gave the 60s the spirit of tremendous hope and possibility, we realized that it's a much more complex story, and that each, many groups of people in society need to have the freedom to define themselves and explore their own realities at the same time as they're working together towards a common goal. And we were not very graceful about that in the 60s because we'd never confronted that before. And it was really the first time when diversity became a reality, and in a political sense, in a broad, deep political sense. And we've kind of, I think, all of us been learning how to operate in a political world that celebrates diversity, but also appreciates the complexity that diversity brings to the table. And we have gotten better at it, and I think your generation is much better at it than we were, although I think our experiences have a lot to offer in terms of particular insights that we gained, or that you, one could gain from our experience now and take advantage of it. Just like there's a lot to learn from the union movement that kind of radically changed the world in the 20s, and from the conflicts between the suffrage movement and the abolitionist movement, and the tremendous strengths of when they worked together.
And so, part of what I took away was the need, the value in working through the messy coalition building of a democratic movement, as opposed to turning to the tempting ease and efficiency of a top-down hierarchical decision-making process. Was that part of what you were trying to get across?
Well, I think that was certainly a tension. How do you balance efficiency with democracy? And that's a tension that will and should never go away. We should always be aware of those kind of two poles and try to wrestle with how to pull it off in a particular situation in the best possible way. But we were not sophisticated at looking at it like that. And in the mid-60s, we had this wonderful, and SDS was wildly democratic and kind of chaotic and creative, and was a really fun organization to work in the mid-60s. But it was also completely incapable of passing a consistent program year after year. And as the stakes got higher, as the war went on and we saw more and more people being killed on the TV every night, as the government began to really go after the movement in this country using a whole array of illegal activities which were exposed after Watergate, up to and including physical attacks on the leadership, including some deaths, it was very hard to continue in this kind of chaotic democratic environment. We felt the need to be much more efficient, to get more done, and we lost sight of how fighting to make the democracy work was really what it was all about. I mean, in writing the book, I like to laugh and say, there is no, you know, that one of the things I learned in the 70s is there is no after the revolution. The change is now, and there are periods of rapid change and slow change, but we're really working on the change on a day-to-day basis.
Let me tell people who have questions, because I know there are going to be a lot, how to call in and join this conversation. This is David Swanson on the People Speak Radio. Our guest is Kathy Wilkerson, the author of Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman. And you can call in toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494, or anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350. That's 877-489-6350. And Kathy, we also have people sending in questions over the internet, and the next one I think is appropriate for this point in the conversation. From Pennsylvania, someone named Art from Pennsylvania asks, why did the weathermen break off from SDS?
Ah, I like that question. In actual fact, as I said, SDS was a very chaotic organization without a consistent national program. One year, we urged people, we wouldn't oppose the draft. The next year, we did oppose the draft. The next year, we canceled the national campaign to encourage draft resistance. It was very inconsistent. And what happened was that SDS got bigger and bigger and bigger. The national meetings, which was really kind of one core piece of it, got more and more chaotic. And a number of small organizations began to sort of dominate the floor in SDS. And we didn't have any procedures to prevent that from happening. And every time people tried to raise the issue of structure in SDS, it was roundly voted down because people didn't want to talk about building a structure for an organization that would last forever. They wanted to talk about the war, or campus recruitment or something like that. So SDS kind of blundered along, getting bigger and bigger with no structure capable of handling an organization like that or of grappling with the issues of democracy and representation in that context. And so what actually happened is in 1969, it imploded. And a lot of people left SDS to go do other things. And the people who caught the pieces, I think, and who were part of that implosion, but certainly not the dominant part, were the leadership of Weatherman. So, yes, they seized the moment as SDS was coming apart at the seams. But by no means do I think, for all of its many faults, did Weatherman cause the implosion of SDS.
Now, I was born in December of 1969, so I missed these years. but in looking back by reading books and speaking with people, I see the civil rights movement as this great, almost Gandhian example of nonviolent activism effecting change. And I wonder why, at 1969, did the Weathermen take a turn toward the use of violence?
Well, it was very organic, because it wasn't just Weathermen that took a turn for violence. There were all kinds of groups, and Weathermen actually was not in the vanguard of it, but were somewhat behind the eight ball. And what happened was the civil rights movement was phenomenally successful in changing the conversation about race and equality in this country and equal opportunity forever. And they changed the realities of voting in the South. But when the civil rights movement began to take on economic equal opportunity in the economic sphere, they ran into a brick wall, really. And King was making that transition and was trying to take on the question of poverty and economic inequality when he was killed. So there was a lot of discouragement about that by 1968, that the problem of poverty seemed, and economic inequality seemed, intractable. And so people began to look around for other models to fight it. And that was out of the civil rights movement. While nonviolence was the overwhelmingly agreed upon tactic in a situation where violence was just overwhelming violence, racist violence in the South was around every corner. Nonviolence was the only possible tactic, and the civil rights leaders understood that. But as the movement moved north, and as the civil rights movement kind of hit this brick wall in the economic sphere, people did begin to look at other models, and the Black Power came out of the Black community, which was not inherently violent, said they were talking about Black political power. But some small faction of Black Power advocates then did begin to advocate armed self-defense, and it was always self-defense. There was never any advocacy of offensive violence, or certainly not, that wasn't the dominant message. And then by the late 60s, as white people, sort of the road that I went down was feeling like, well, the Black movement is talking about armed self-defense. People are getting killed because in the Black Panther Party, because of the illegal COINTELPRO program run by the FBI, people were getting hurt and were getting killed. It seemed that it was not acceptable for white people to sit on the side because we could. That the only legitimate step for a white person to take was to put ourselves in the same position as people in Vietnam or people in the Black Panther Party or people in other parts of the world that were trying to fight for independence and equality. And it was that reasoning, I think, that then began to make, it, certainly for me, and really with Weatherman, there were all kinds of people who felt all kinds of ways, so I can really only speak for myself. But it was sure. That reasoning that was very persuasive to me.
And that's and a reasoning fun, that... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just was going to add that Frantz Fanon, who was a very widely read and popular and very smart author, a Black psychotherapist who worked in Algeria and Africa, he made the argument that nonviolence was the privilege of the elite. And that nonviolence was not an option for most people in the world. And that was persuasive to me as well.
And the Wretched of the Earth was the big book by
yes.
him that influenced you. And I mean, this is a very interesting argument, and at first a compelling argument as you read this book, and one that I think a lot of people today don't even get far enough along in to come down on one side or the other, and that is that here our nation is slaughtering Vietnamese, and they are fighting back and presumably don't have the option of nonviolence, although one could argue in a Gandhian way that they ought to have employed massive nonviolence. But here we are sitting in the homeland of the empire, as we call it now, and fat and happy and not under threat of murder or torture, and we ought to, if we think that their self-defense is right, we ought to be joining in it and doing what we can here at home. And yet, in the end, I find the argument unconvincing, and I'm wondering if, in retrospect, exactly what you think or what you might have done differently.
Well, in the conclusion of the book, as I wrote the book, I tried to not second guess how I thought back then. I tried to tell the story coherently and sharply of my thinking at the time because I wanted to show what that process was like and what the environment was that produced that kind of thinking. In the conclusion of the book, I say the core of sort of how I think about it now, which is that there's a flaw in that argument, which is that Fanon's argument, I now understand, was very based in the male experience. And Fanon also argued that violence was redemptive, that it helped break people out of the passivity and depression of colonialism and of the defeatism of colonialism. And that seemed very persuasive to me, but as I developed a feminist consciousness over the years, I realized that it's really what Fanon was talking about, and I still have enormous respect for Fanon, but he was talking about restoring sort of the aggressive manhood of men, and that, in fact, that's not a quality that's been really helpful in the world. And that
far from it.
What we need to do is look at it much more from a cooperative world. What does it take to build cooperation, and how can we be creative and smart about that in situations that are on the edge of violence? That doesn't mean that if people are physically I am not a pacifist on a personal basis, although, as I say in the book, I have enormous respect for people who are, and without pacifists, I think no movement can succeed. But I think on a global scale, the level of violence now is so extensive, and the nature of weapons is so devastating, and the effects last for generations, like the depleted uranium that's been used in Afghanistan, that it's not even possible to think about waging a successful defensive war anymore, other than in the most localized kind of way. And that we have to really develop a new generation of political and physical tactics to prevent violence. But I don't think answering violence with violence can work anymore. Whether or not it's politically correct or politically expedient, at this point in time, it's suicidal.
It's a very interesting suggestion, and I want to speak with you about Iraq. But as a male pacifist, I hope that we can get someday to where characteristics of men are not what was being developed in Wretched of the Earth. But let's bring another woman in on this conversation and see what she has to ask. We have Basima from Michigan on line 3. Basima, thanks for calling in to the People Speak.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Kathy, for being here. I admire your work tremendously. One of the things that I'd like to ask you is, I feel that in a day and age where revolution is probably the only path to restoring any kind of sanity to an insane world, I find that most people are tremendously afraid of revolution, and the issue of revolution being some kind of a violent episode doesn't necessarily have to be true, that there is dissent, there is nonviolent revolution. How do you feel about revolution? Because I see you as a revolutionary. I really do.
Well, I, as you can tell, I have trouble with the word revolution because I feel like it's been stereotyped, like you said. When I talk about revolution, I talk about the Industrial Revolution or a revolution of ideas like the Civil Rights Movement was, the Civil Rights Movement was the revolution of the 60s, where it was no longer acceptable to exclude people on the basis of race from the initial process. It still happens. And there's big fights going on around it now, but it's not acceptable in the mainstream political dialogue. So yes, if we fight for a new definition of the word revolution, I think revolutions are possible and necessary. I haven't come up with a way to describe, when I think of myself, I think of myself as somebody who has and continues to devote my life, because I love doing it, trying to make the world a more equitable and peaceful place. In that, to me, is the definition of a revolutionary, not somebody who looks for the next barricade to climb up.
We are very, very quickly arrived at the midway point in this hour program, and we're going to have to take a quick break. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio with our guest, Kathy Wilkerson, and we will be right back, and we will be taking your calls right after this.
According to polls, a majority of Americans support the impeachment of Dick Cheney. To make people aware of this, the Honk to Impeach campaign has been organized. People will be carrying Honk to Impeach signs in front of congressional district offices and TV and radio stations. Visit ImpeachSpace.com and ImpeachCheney.org for updates of this effort. And don't forget to honk for impeachment.
This land is yours.
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit sosmorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio. This is David Swanson, and you can call in toll-free to join us in conversation with Kathy Wilkerson, the author of Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman. You can call from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada toll-free at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494, or anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6399. Kathy, in terms of what the peace movement accomplished during the war in Vietnam, what role, if any, do you think that it played in bringing that war to a halt and in accomplishing other goals of moving us from militarism toward peace?
Well, I think there's no question that if there hadn't been a peace movement in this country and in Europe and other places, that Nixon would have used nuclear weapons or some really horrifying combination of traditional weapons, and that the only restraint that kept him from doing that was the peace movement. So I think there's no question that the peace movement restrained the war in the later stages, and eventually, and I think that Nixon's need to completely reorganize his political campaign and his economic and political program around the war led to the kinds of corruption that surfaced in Watergate. And so Nixon's support of the war really pushed him to the wall, and his inability to listen to the American people and caused Watergate to happen. So the anti-war movement was tremendously important. Now, in terms of actually ending the war, there's no question that the GIs and the veterans played the critical edge of actually ending the war, because they created a situation in which the United States did no longer had an effective army that they could field. And that was really, in many ways, the way the Civil War was won as well. And so when the producers of the food supply for the Southern Army stopped producing food, and the Southern Army collapsed. So that was the particular piece, but the GIs and the veterans couldn't have done what they did without the more broader peace movement as part of the support. And the peace movement also educated millions of people about the war who would not have otherwise understood what it was about, much in the way that the anti-war movement today has educated and brought in an ever larger group of people to oppose the war in the Middle East.
In terms of that war going on now, the occupation of Iraq in particular, I'm curious how you would apply the sort of moral reasoning that you did in the 60s to Vietnam, in that, you know, most of us believe that the Iraqis have a right of violent self-defense, but we aren't engaged in violence to assist them. And some would argue, and I would argue, that actually the Iraqis should be using nonviolence, although it's hard for it to be my place to tell them to put their lives at risk with nonviolence, particularly when I'm not doing it every day here. What do you make of this question now in terms of supporting the violent Iraqi resistance?
Well, the situation in Iraq is very different than Vietnam. In Vietnam, there was a coherent movement and leadership that had been in place since the 20s and the 30s, and a movement for national independence that had worked to end French colonialism and then and to fend off China and then fend off the United States. It was a movement that was very thoughtful and carefully built. That kind of a movement doesn't exist in Iraq. And the one in Vietnam had massive popular support. That's not true in Iraq, which is has had a very, the whole Middle East, once oil was on the agenda and various oil companies went into all parts of the Middle East, carved it up, European powers carved up the countries and created the boundaries. It's been a region that was fraught with competition for oil, basically. So the issues there are very deep and complicated, and the overlay is kind of this reactive religious part that now plays a big role. And on the top layer is really this issue around which you see more sharply in Afghanistan between men and women, and the issue of the recolonization of women on a global scale, of which warfare is a part of. So I think I'm not an expert at all on the war in Iraq. I don't know it in the kind of depth that I knew Vietnam, so I'm not the right person to speak on it in any depth, but it seems to me it's a very complicated situation, and what's needed are very, very creative political solutions. And I don't hear a lot of those coming out of Iraq at the moment.
I have a couple of follow-up questions to that, but I want to bring in a caller who's on the line from California. Mike, thanks for calling the People Speak Radio.
Thank you very much. Hello, Kathy. It's good to have you on the show. I feel like I'm talking to a survivor and somebody who has a great deal of wisdom because of what you've gone through, especially the prison and all those turbulent times during the 60s and 70s. And I'd like to know, from that vantage point, who do you support for president?
I support the Democratic candidate. You know, I think it's very exciting that we have some substantive political conversation going on in the national level. I don't think it's going to be the wave of the future. I think it's a moment in time when a series of circumstances have come together to force the candidates to have a substantive conversation to some extent. And I think that's great for the political process. It has brought in a lot of young people, which I think is really, really important. And So, and I think there's strengths and weaknesses of both of the Democratic candidates, obviously. But it's not something I think I really want to weigh in on. I voted already in the New York primary, so, but I'm gonna lay low on that one because I have, as a woman, I've been horrified by the way that Hillary was attacked, by the way she's been, sort of vilified in a lot of the press, the kind of insufferable sexist jokes that are told relentlessly. Oh, here's Hillary. Will she iron my shirts? So I'm very outraged about that. I'm also very glad that Obama is at least trying to raise a new vision. I can't speak on the issue of I don't have the facts in front of me about the various interest groups that both of them are beholden to in different ways. So, you know, they're both mainstream national political candidates, and by in and of itself that means something in this world because of the money question. So I still think the most critical political dialogue is happening at the local level and at most at the state level. And I certainly hope that a Democratic candidate wins. I think it'll make a huge difference. But what really matters is the local and state level political struggles and involvement.
Well, I have to applaud anybody who's willing to admit that something is more important than the current presidential contest, which has been imminent for over a year and will continue to be until November. Yet again, the most important election in history, and I'm not convinced, but it is interesting that a lot of young people see rallying around Obama as what they should be doing to make a better world. And at the same time, we have a newly reborn SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. I wonder if you've had any contact and what you think of that. We have young people getting involved in the movement to actually break through this pretense that the next 10 months don't exist and try to compel the Congress to end the current war. And we have at least a fledgling resistance movement in the military and the Iraq Veterans Against the War planning to present testimony, winter soldier testimony, in an echo of what Vietnam vets did back then this month in Washington. What do you make of the current peace movement and the current state of activism in this country?
Well, I think typed this era starting with the Seattle demonstrations and moving forward from there. And I think it's really wonderful that there's the movement today is much larger and much more diverse than it was in the 60s. And I think sometimes, because in the 60s it was so new and it was so different, it seemed it was much more at the center of national attention. Now it's much more embedded all across the country and in all kinds of venues, and that's a wonderful thing. I think it's a hard time to be an activist because there isn't the sense of imminent possibility that we had back then. But my generation knows things can change overnight radically. And I guess young people today know that too because they lived through September 11th when things changed radically overnight. Not in a good way, but...
Right. Not necessarily for the better.
Go ahead.
I want to let people know to call into the program, and do we need to get those numbers out? In the U.S. and Canada, you can call in toll-free to join us at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Or anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350. That's 877-489-6350. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio with Kathy Wilkerson. And Kathy, you mentioned early in this show the experience of seeing people being killed on television night after night. And today, for whatever reasons, and I would argue largely the incredible conglomeration, the monopolization of ownership of our communication system, we don't see that so much. Is that largely because peace protests aren't new anymore and marches in the street are old hat, or is it because of the corporate interests of the people who run our airwaves?
Oh, there's no question that it's the latter. I mean, when we, and also it's a, in the 60s, television news was still a new genre, and there was a whole bunch of young, very courageous, creative, in the field reporters. Today, television news is entertainment. And so you don't, it doesn't generate that kind of, there's no support for, financial support for those kind of reporters to go out and find those stories. They do appear from time to time. But also, I think the American people are not riveted to the news in the way they were in the 60s when it was not competing with, I mean, and this is a much broader cultural issue, but marketing and advertising has now gotten to a level of sophistication where the media is just filled with appeals to passive addiction, whether it's addiction to salt and sugar in terms of food or drugs or brand names or people passively watching other people's lives over and over again, or some kind of ritualistic violence. These, the media, both the entertainment and the ads, appeals to the of human nature's ability and vulnerability to addiction of one sort or another. And so, as a people, we have not learned how yet to rise above that, and not be seduced by that into doing what we're told by that kind of media. And so, to me, that's kind of a big issue around TV and all the media, is that people see the media now as a place to go to get their kind of addictive fantasies satisfied, rather than as a place to go to become active participants in a democracy.
Exactly. You know, and one of the forces that seems to create a lack of activism and involvement now, and I'm wondering, and I'd like to know what you think, how much this is new and how much this has always been the case, is the role of political parties, in that, you know, we have this peace movement that the corporate media presents to the world that's actually a bunch of quite heavily funded Democratic front groups that intend to use the war as a campaign issue and run TV ads against John McCain, but not actually ask any Democrats to cut off the funding or end the war. And we have this peace movement that is not so much heard about in the corporate media, that even within itself is bickering over whether we should demand what we really want, and that is stop funding the thing, or play along with the Democrats because they're better with the Republicans and pass bills that we know are going to be vetoed and it's all for show, but it's better than nothing, you know. And there seems to be this incredible top-down force of a political party, the opposition political party such as it is, this taking over the grassroots activist groups rather than the other way around, as perhaps it should be. Am I right in thinking that this has gotten worse?
Well, I don't know. All those same battles happened in the 60s around, you know, I mean, this was an issue in SDS. As some of the founders of SDS thought that the purpose of SDS was really to be involved in the Democratic Party and to push the Democratic Party in a more populist direction. And so those people never wanted to make demands that would place them out of the loop of the inner power circles of the Democratic Party. So this discussion has been going on, and it's a complicated issue. How do you how do you do that? And it's one of the reasons why I think that these fights on the national forum is not the place to have these fights, that it's really the local and at most the state level forums where you can actually keep the substance on the table and you are in a position of being able to craft policy that has some relationship to reality. So I can't, you know, I don't know what to say about it on the national level other than focus elsewhere.
Let's bring in, we're running towards the end of the program, but let's bring in a woman from my local part of the world. Rain from Richmond, Virginia is on the line. Thanks for calling, Rain. Rain, can you hear me? Okay, we missed her. We'll try again momentarily.
I can hear you.
Oh, Rain, are you there?
Yeah, no, I am here. I'm sorry. I wanted to thank you, David, and for doing this program, and thank you to Kathy for, you know, being a hero, and I'm so honored to be able to speak with you. My question, there's a number of things, as David mentioned earlier, you know, these national looking like anti-war groups, like Americans Against the Escalation in Iraq and so forth, that turn out not to be what they are, that is a hard thing to discern unless you're like completely internet savvy and can figure out who pays for what. One of the things that have been coming up in my hometown of Richmond, Virginia, is more and more police at public protests. You know, we stand in front of our congressman's office trying to get him to sign on into impeachment. Recently we had policemen come with undergarments, you know, they're like full body gear. They look like football players, to say, we were called to this disorderly group, and, you know, we're not. And then the mounted police coming around and around. I mean, how would Kathy suggest we protect ourselves from being attacked for doing our First Amendment right, which is free speech?
Good question.
I mean, these are all things that happen to us as well. I mean, we had the National Student Association, which turned out to be funded by the CIA in part, and within which the CIA was active in generating policy. And we had, you know, other kinds of covert meddling with political organizations of all kinds. And one has to assume that even though Watergate exposed our round and it made it illegal, that it's still going on a much more sophisticated level. And so it's a reality, it's a political reality that we have to live with in democracy now and have to both be aware of and talk about and expose, but also move beyond. So I think the issue around police being intimidating and threatening and trying to scare people away from being activists is part of what how the political establishment reacts. And usually there's a political piece behind it. I mean, the police don't act that way independently. We don't. There are exceptions of rogue police forces and rogue police officers, but there's often political policy behind it. And again, all I can say is, I mean, in the 60s, our creativity was our strongest suit. And so if there's a way to ridicule them, to make their armor seem, you know, to bring fans or something so they don't get too hot in their body armor. I mean, all of those kind of things that expose the absurdity of what they're doing, that they're trying to define the conversation by the clothes they wear. They're trying to define how people respond to this demonstration. So if you can undermine that and expose that and make it look silly, sometimes that's a powerful tactic. And that's not the only tactic. That's just the one that happens to pop into my head at the moment. But I think if we can't be creative, they're going to continue to define the conversation, and as long as they define the conversation, they're stronger. So I don't have answers, obviously, and I am not on the street now because I'm sort of embedded in the inner city education stuff, and I work 24 hours a day on that. So I go to the big demonstrations, and I try to show up when it matters, and I, you know, try to follow what's going on enough to know. But I think there are, I know in Texas, the SDS chapter there just had a wonderful series of really creative demonstrations there, and I think the young people in SDS and many other organizations have picked up that banner of creativity, and my hat's off to them.
So
I don't know if that's helpful. Sorry.
I think rain is gone, but I think it's extremely helpful. We have only a couple of minutes left in the program, and I wanted to hear something about what you are doing these days with inner city education. And I just also wanted to ask, in your book, you talk a lot about how angry you were, and you don't sound very angry. Are you not angry anymore?
Oh, I'm every bit as angry as I was.
You are.
But I've learned how to live with that it can't take over your whole life. That there's no way to live in this world and not be furious. But at the same time, there has to be room for all of the other emotions of love and joy and humor and all of that. So I think, you know, that's a product of my having lived a few more years that I've learned how to do that.
Maybe we can all get there. And just briefly, what are you working on in terms of education now, and why is that an important place to be?
Well, I'm fascinated by it because I realized in the 70s, I mean, part of my upbringing as a female was that I had no access to math and science information other than sort of basic school math. When I was in ninth grade, transistor radios came out, and I wanted to know what a transistor was. And I had no way of knowing what is this thing about silicon? Why does it work the way it does? And why has it allowed technology to change so radically? And so, in my life, I've tried to learn a lot more now that science is accessible to women, a lot more about sort of the underlying basis of the technological revolution that we're all living through. And I think many of the big decisions of the 21st century, everything from what to do with all that plastic to global warming to the after effects of warfare to health, all of these require literacy in math and science. And if we're going to be intelligent participants in the democracy as a people, we have to have mass literacy in math and science. On what the big issues are, the basic way that our world works chemically and biologically and physically, and that this is a very exciting kind of knowledge to have if you have access to learning it in a way that discovers it and explores it as a real scientist does. And so my commitment in the last 20 years has really been to bring this kind of access to exciting math and science to people in inner cities who traditionally have been excluded, as I was, from this whole body of knowledge, and therefore excluded from the critical decision-making of the next period of time.
Well, I have to say my son, who's 2 years old, I think has the scientific tendencies that you had and his daddy never had, and I hope he gets a teacher like you someday. Kathy, I really appreciate the time you've taken to be with us this hour. Kathy Wilkerson is the author of Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman, and I highly recommend it. Kathy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It was wonderful to talk with all of you.
And let me tell everyone what's coming up in the next week on the People Speak Radio Network. Next Tuesday, Basima Farhat will be with Cynthia Morgan, the author of Cindy in Iraq. That's 8 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday. And a week from tonight, next Wednesday, David Swanson, that's me, will be interviewing U.S. Senate candidate from the state of Maine, Lori Dobson. Please join us. This is the People Speak Radio. Good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief of the fast, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream Wall.